Hello, creeps. I'll be your ghost. I mean host. As we delve the crypts of spooky movies and even spookier theory, welcome to Horror Vanguard.
Hello, everybody. Hello, everyone. It is your Horror Vanguard for the week. How are you? I hope you're doing well. We are here in the astrology tower of the HV Crypt. We're looking for the once every three centuries comet, which is about to make its presence felt in the Earth sky. And I'm joined by the HV official astronomer and cataloger of all space bodies, Ash. How are you doing, my friend?
That moves me one step closer to just becoming 7 of 9, so that's all right. I'll take it. Yeah, straight here from Horror Vanguard Astrometrics. You know, before climate change, these once every three century meteors used to be so much rarer. It feels like they happen twice a season now.
Yeah, I mean, it's like every other week, there's a once every three centuries meteor.
Okay, now I'm imagining like a hardcore climate denialist, except for they're like, meteors aren't striking more often. What do you say to that, global warming?
Yeah, take that, NASA.
Today, I think we have one of those fun movies that's at once an homage to the best Star Trek spinoff episodes, and then also all about destabilizing the global South for fun and for profit.
Yeah,
so it's going to be a good zombie movie.
Yeah, it's a great zombie movie about the CIA doing coups in Nicaragua, and how important found family truly is.
I couldn't agree more. I think this is a very special episode today here on Horror Vanguard. It's really heartwarming, very touching.
We are, of course, talking about the classic 1980s horror movie, Night of the Comet. And this is something that was suggested to us by an HV listener. It was suggested by Rowan. Rowan, thank you so much for bringing this to our attention. It was on the Discord server. And yeah, I'm really excited to dig into this. And so it is now my great pleasure to turn to senior Horror Vanguard tenured professor in astrological bodies, Ash, to explain, to guide our eyes upward to the cosmic void of the night sky, and explain what today's film, Night of the Comet, is about.
Hurtling into our neighborhood of the solar system, hundreds of glowing wanderers loop around the sun. They are comets. And the most famous is...
Lately, I've been locked in a hypnotic groove by Spinoza's most damning single line, "Why do people fight for their servitude as if it was their salvation?" As climate apocalypse ceases to be a distant theme of forward-facing sci-fi, and increasingly becomes that ever-present specter weighing down everything, there's a lag in our perceptual understanding of the end times as expressed in our cinematic arts. Cinema renders the collapse of our world either as something preventable by a plucky group of technocrats, or a foregone conclusion, an event that has not just always already happened, but one that ended before we were ever aware of it. Cinematic knowing moves to negate the apocalypse as anything beyond a binary state that can be toggled on and off as needed by plot. The problem has become that our understanding of what an apocalypse can look like is defined by these movies. If there isn't a near total depopulation of our planet, if roving biker gangs aren't vying for control of shopping centers, if we can't make up cute aphorisms like, "Oh, those creatures out there? We call them jumpers," then it's just not the apocalypse. No matter how much of our home becomes irrevocably destroyed, the apocalypse is an astonishing event. No matter what else, it keeps defying ready-made frameworks of knowing. As such, why not turn to Anti-Oedipus, Deleuze, and Guattari's classic text to help dislodge the known? They write, "The astonishing thing is not that some people steal or that others occasionally go out on strike. but rather that all who are starving do not steal is regular practice, and all those who are exploited are not continually on strike. Maybe we're waiting for someone to call action so that we can start the movie that is our lives. Could it be we're too beholden, no, absolutely enthralled by this notion of cinema speed? The end of Night of the Comet is an easy lambast of the nuclear family. That is a readily available textual reading essentially printed out with the script. But it's not enough. It's a reading that falls short of the demands of our moment. So, faster. Move in deeper. Commit to reading the text on its terms. Our apocalyptic survivors do recreate cis-hetero norms, but that's just the surface. They form a non-traditional found family unit in the rubble of a world that is either literally trying to kill them, or would easily allow them to die from neglect. Listeners, does that not sound hauntingly familiar? But it's still not enough. It's still just a back and forth, so faster still. There's always an uncomfortable third in every movie, the viewer absorbing the gaze of the camera. Whether we are critical of these survivors and their puerile actions, or we find sympathies for them, it's still just navel-gazing. It's still just unknowingly staring into a mirror and mocking the other we see reflected. Faster, deeper, and through the self. If everything is lost, if, like the heroes of our movies, the apocalypse has come and gone without the moment of our response, then our grief-laced reactions to the depictions of the apocalyptic makes a certain kind of moribund sense. We aren't armchair critics arguing about fictitious zombie movie rules. We are post-apocalyptic survivors critiquing and commenting from a place on the other side of a rare and specific trauma. I have so many feelings about how Regina and Hector handle the apocalypse because I am also a post-apocalyptic survivor who's kicking around a movie theater as my skies change beyond my control and governments fail to respond. Margaret Kiljoy, of Feminazgul fame, recently wrote a blog on climate grief saying, "We can build something beautiful in the shell of the old world, but it will have a certain cemetery beauty." As a teen, I had so much fun in cemeteries. They were a third space where I could do everything from finding a quiet place to read to meeting friends for some late-night fun. Even if everything is lost, we can still make sure that there is a beautiful graveyard for all children born onto the apocalypse to enjoy. The red dust in our skies shows no sign of settling, but then again, neither do we. Join us as we discuss Night of the Comet.
There is no Los Angeles. 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 There is no Los Angeles.
Oh, I can barely tell you've been reading Nick Land lately.
Shut up, Dad.
I learned it from you.
I was just finishing the Accelerationism primer before starting the cute Accelerationism book that just came out while I was writing this precy. So definitely I'm not drawing at all from Marx's like notes on machines or anything like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah,
certainly
yeah. I can
not in this text.
I can barely tell that we are hashtag accelerating.
There wasn't anything in there. There's nothing to look at in this precy. I wasn't also reading Dune while I was writing that one, so that didn't come out in there at all.
But I don't
have influences. The precies emerge from a place of pure takes. I am just their vessel.
Yeah, I like, you know, Mark Fisher said this about K-punk, that K-punk was not a persona. It was a signal, right? All Mark considered himself to be was a kind of a meat suit that channeled the K-punk modulation through themselves into the cyberspace. And honestly, that's how the H3 precies work. As an observer, that's what I think, right? It's you tap into the knowledge beyond the ken of normal humanity.
and by knowledge beyond the ken of normal humanity, you mean what was the last book published by Urbanomic?
Urbanomic, call us. We've been talking about your books for a long time.
We give you a lot of free publicity. The least you could do is send me a free book. Shipping costs from the UK are extortionate.
Yeah, just one or two.
Which is not your fault, Urbanomic, just to make that clear. Oh, but that's enough of Horror Vanguard's favorite publisher's hour. This is something that we've been forgetting to do for, I don't know, many years now, maybe half
only
a decade.
About 5 years?
Shrug, just forgetting to thank our wonderful listeners who suggest some of these episodes to us. So thank you, Rowan, and retrospectively, thank you a list of unnamed howling ghouls from the nether regions of the crypt who have suggested many movies before, Rowan.
But if you would like to suggest a film, the very best and easiest way of doing that is becoming a patron of the show at horrorvanguard.com or through patreon.com/horrorvanguard. We keep a record of every film that's been suggested, and you know, we do try and work our way through it as often as we can. I'm sure there are lots of people listening who are like, you know, they did this because I suggested it and they never thanked me. This is a retroactive thanks to anyone who's ever suggested a film that we should check out. And as Ash said, we are going to try and get a little better at kind of thanking the people who suggest the movie as it comes up. But let us begin. Let us drive into the deserted mall that is the formalism zone.
And I think the best way to enter the formalism zone is by saying engage. So there's a point in this movie, right? So Sam and Regina are sisters, and they break into the local radio station because they, after the apocalypse, they hear the radio playing and they're like, oh my God, someone's there. Sam, the younger sister, is kind of, you know, enthralled by all of the like cool radio tech and becoming a radio DJ herself. And she says the line, "Beam me up, Scotty." And immediately after saying that line, Who rounds the corner besides Robert Beltran, who listeners of the show should immediately recognize as Chakotay from Star Trek Voyager? Does this movie have prescience? Is Night of the Comet aware of all possible futures? Is this the, like, hermetic religious text we've been needing to uncover the secrets of our moment? Because it did predict Star Trek Voyager.
I mean, is this not a kind of hyperstition, right?
Who's been reading Nick Land now?
So what is Voyager, right? Voyager is a spin-off of a spin-off, right? It is a forward projection of an originary idea in the utopian science fiction of the 60s and 70s, or even the late 50s and 60s. That was the original series. Then we had Next Generation, then we had Voyager. And in a way, there is something of the same imagined structure happening in Night of the Comet, right? So you had, I mean, obviously, the kind of first real ancestor is Romero's movies, right? Night of the Living Dead, which is, I think, a profoundly utopian kind of cosmic horror. Then you have Dawn of the Dead and Day of the Dead, which again are tied up in these discourses of militarization, of commercialization, of commodity fetishism. So I'm like, this Night of the Comet as a film is basically an echo of an echo of an echo, and in its forward projection through cultural history, you have this echo of the echo of the echo. Of all focalized through the career of of Robert Beltran.
Oh, that is so beautiful. I really like that take. That was quite good. I lost my mind. I just completely had just a little freak out when that happened. Just beam me up, Scotty, and then just
and then
wham, who's the camera focus on? But none other than Chakotay. It's literally immediately. She's like, beam me up, Scotty, and then like Chakotay rounds a corner in the background. And I'm like, that to me made this entire movie work as like a feature length, like side episode of Voyager where they get like sucked into, he's got to go down on a planet and investigate this pre-warp civilization. So he has to disguise himself as one of the local populace. It just works so well,
like,
with that kind of conceptual framework.
In that context, it sort of feels like a Star Trek novel. Right. I'm revealing way too much of myself of what I read when I was a lonely 15-year-old. But it feels a little bit too niche to be an actual like mainstream episode. But like that would be a Voyager universe novel that was just this. That was just Chakotay going on a road trip through a post-apocalyptic world. I could totally see this working as like a Star Trek expanded universe novel. Of course that's not the only, you know, cultural echo that this has got. Because this is a Buffy movie. This is wild to me as I am for my sins the Buffy agnostic on this show. I am not one of the true believers. I have not seen the light of heaven. I will not be saved into Joss Whedon's paradise. But like so as someone who knows a lot more about Buffy than I do, what are your thoughts on Joss Whedon saying that this movie was like an influence on developing the show?
I mean, obviously this seems very true, right? There's a lot of strong parallels between Regina and Buffy. And in terms of like the construction of the show, like that I can see bits of it as well, right? Because like famously, like Joss Whedon was very much like, oh, Buffy's the strong female protagonist fighting monsters. It's an inversion of like the damsel trope. And so that's like, okay, we see that in Night of the Comet. Like we see like the core base component of it there. And there is also a little bit of like a preempting of what would become Joss Whedon's script writing in this, I feel. There's a little bit of like snarky self-awareness in this film, but it doesn't come off quite as like, like during Buffy, the snarky self-awareness is charming because I think it's really early in the evolution of that type of like writing comedy and writing sitcoms. But by the time we get to today, it's just so fucking saccharine and just insufferable.
Well, that just happened.
Well, then, oh my God, he's right behind me, isn't he? You might be wondering how I got here.
Yeah, record scratch, freeze frame. There's something quite charming I find about the script for Night of the Comet, where it's like it's a lot of like Valley Girl stereotypes. It's kind of a little bit silly, but yeah, there's something quite charming about the script. I think I actually sort of enjoy it, and I think it's. But you're quite right. The seeds of the latencies of what would become the kind of like miasma of sarcasm masquerading as humor that has enveloped popular culture. You can kind of see it. You can kind of see where it all came from in this period of like the mid 80s.
Oh, absolutely. And I think a lot of that, like, because I agree, this movie is really charming. I really, really enjoyed Night of the Comet. So it's a fantastic movie. And part of that, I think we'll talk about zombies in a second, I guess, but like part of that is like how minimal the zombies were in this film. But I think another and bigger part of that for me was that like, so Tom Eberhardt, while writing the script, interviewed like teen girls and kind of asked them like, hey, like if there was an apocalypse and all the adults were gone, what would you be doing? What would you want to do? What would you be concerned about? And like, you know, as the story, as Eberhardt's self-reporting of this goes, like they're all like, oh, they'd want to go shopping. They'd want to hang out with friends. They'd want to go, you know, like get a cool car or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, like he like asked them like more leading questions and like got dating as like a big answer. So that's why there's all these like romantic hangups in these films, or in this film rather. But that does lend it a kind of authenticity. There is something, you know, like the aura of being genuine in this film. It has that kind of playful juvenilia that allows it to be a bit free of a more serious and jaded adult perspective, which I think lends it to more serious criticism.
Yeah, this is what we might call a fun-pocalypse. Right? It's a fun-pocalypse. It's fine. You don't need to worry about, like, you're really annoying stepmother because she's gonna die soon, and then you were gonna go to the mall and it's gonna be great. And you're completely correct in saying that the zombies are kind of incidental to this, and I think that's kind of how you make a good zombie movie, right? They become like, if they are the sum total, they tend to collapse under the weight of their own metaphoric construction. But when they are kept as like something like just an additional hazard that has to be negotiated within the totality of the world in which they're occurring, then you actually get something much more interesting out of them.
I'm a firm believer of the kind of thinking that in a sufficiently good zombie movie, you could replace the zombies with a natural disaster and the movie would still be just as good. You could like the kind of plot function and threat posed by the zombie could be replaced by radioactive fallout. It could be replaced by an earthquake, a tornado, a hurricane, you know, or in this case, a comet.
No, I could not agree more. I think that's entirely correct. And yeah, there is something kind of really fun, and nothing about this film is taken too seriously in its script or in its action. But my goodness, we will get on to what this film is actually about as we enter the discourse zone.
Oh my god. Okay, so we need to talk about Regina's dad.
If you recommended this movie to us, Rowan, you knew what we were gonna focus on. Okay. just lead us into this area.
Okay, so we don't meet Reggie's dad. We don't ever really see him personally. We don't get any lines from him. We don't get a phone call or anything. So he's completely absent. But we do learn about him a lot from a few key scenes. And the first is with Regina and Sam's stepmother, who makes a comment that he's off somewhere in South America. And, you know, he's going to come home if a Sandinista doesn't put a bullet in his head first. Then we get another line about him, their dad being down in a banana republic, in quotes. And then we get a scene where they're like shooting like MAC-10s or something. And Sam is like, "Oh, dad would have got us Uzis," which was an improv line, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
But that's besides the point. We learned that their dad is doing like School of the Americas death squad shit.
Yep. Yep. Let's talk about Nicaragua. let's talk
Jesus
about the
Christ. Go on.
I thought this was just going to be like a fun movie about, you know, Valley Girls surviving the apocalypse. I didn't realize it was going to be a scathing indictment of the decay of the family structure in bourgeois America as like normative masculinity is like thrown into a global geopolitical struggle against like the revolutionary movements of the global South. Like, this is a movie that is directly connected in its text, not in its subtext, but in its text to like Iran-Contra.
And this is like, I think this speaks to kind of the teenage energy that's in this film. Because by allowing that to kind of be a few throwaway lines in the background, I think it much more successfully baits a discursive hook than if the movie would have kind of attempted more directly to deliver some kind of commentary on that.
Yeah, like the world literally ends. All adults just vanish. But the only place that we know where adults might be is in military organizing. Like, if you look at the details of what the US did, particularly in Nicaragua, and the ways in which, you know, there was the revolutionary struggle, there was a kind of counter-revolution with the Contra movement, like moving cocaine through the country, like death squads. Mm-hmm. Like, this is entirely in keeping with like the excellent reporting work and historical work done by Vincent Bevins in the Jakarta Method. Like, the entire point of American geopolitical strategy in the 70s and 80s was to keep communism out of South America. Or not even communism, to keep like mild social democracy and social reform under wraps. And it's so, it's like, it's kind of mind-blowing that just in a few lines of dialogue, this film manages to, like, completely recontextualize everything that happens in it. This is a Cold War movie. Mm-hmm. This is...
This is, it's so intensely strange and bizarre how that just gets thrown into the movie and then just entirely changes my perspective on every single thing that's about to happen in the context of this film, and especially the kind of like those the kind of Cold War conflicts are often like a silent partner in a lot of American media and especially American history. And by letting their silence kind of ring in this movie, you kind of see the wreckage of that. You kind of see how that disjoints and fundamentally restructures American living. And it just elevates Night of the Comet from like, yeah, what would be like a Buffy episode or something, or a mm-hmm. Buffy film concept, I don't know, to like incredibly scathing political commentary.
My timelines are not amazing here, but like the Sandinista revolution will have already have taken place in Nicaragua. And so
yes,
that was
yep.
the 60s and 70s. So this is the era of counter-revolution where the US is like funneling money to Contra death squads to try mm-hmm. and bring down the, you know, a government that was started by like student activists in Nicaragua. So like this...
Yep.
This is the lodestar to not just like interpreting this film, but I think actually making sense of American popular culture in the 1980s, full stop.
And I think like the kind of like difficult to parse timelines of what this movie is evoking here, I think is honestly really important too, because that doesn't, I don't think that points us towards like, well, I think it does. It does point us both towards like a broken understanding of the history of the American involvement in like South American politics. And it points to the fact that that stuff is so incredibly ongoing and never stopped. And there is no like easily sliced line between the beginning and end of a conflict like France and England. You know, there are many wars. Like this is an intracted, ongoing, continuing political conflict that is not yet over. So having our characters be a bit laissez-faire about the time, I think, is really revealing of several things.
Actually, I just did a little quick double check of something. So this comes out in 1984. Yep. 1984 is also the year of the Nicaraguan election when Ortega wins the presidency with like 60% of the vote. And this mm-hmm. is the election that goddamn Ronald Reagan decries as a Soviet-style sham election. And it's like it's a colossal failure of American counter-revolutionary effort, right? The Contras don't win, at least not at this juncture. And it's like it's so funny that the girls are just like, oh yeah, daddy's gonna be off, and hopefully some pinko commie's not gonna shoot him. It's like, well, maybe that's a real possibility though.
Oh my god. So I think this leads us into another, I'll say politically nauseating thing that's in this movie. We have to talk about the think tank, because there is so much to discuss when it comes to this think tank that the only place I know where to begin when discussing of this think tank is that their fucking logo is the sun and rod.
This is
like one pixel off from being the sun and rod.
Yeah, this is so wild. So Reggie and Sam, when they meet Hector at the radio station, they kind of go and they realize that what they've been listening to is a pre-record. They go live on air and they are heard by these scientists in a kind of bunker somewhere. And again, this is a Cold War movie. This is about American anxiety of the Cold War. And these scientists are working for not a government body, but some nameless think tank and experimenting on kids. And there's weird things about like mm-hmm. blood infections. And again, all of this is happening in the 1980s. And what else might have been going on in the cultural popular consciousness? Mm. I don't know. This is a strong critique of neo-fascist, of like eco-fascist Malthusianism.
This is expressly the case because like the, and even like, you know, like we can really tear this apart too, because the think tank doesn't have a hierarchical structure.
Nope.
They make references so many times to like their kind of council approach to their internal politics. So we could see really a really clear example in the think tank in this, how the right can appropriate a lot of left talking points and left like organizational tactics and aesthetic strategies, but still do just a straight up Malthusian fascist project centered around some kind of like environmental concern. And like with this too, like they have so many lines where like they're attempting to save like the most brilliant and brightest scientists, which also like, I mean, like, you know, it's very Malthusian, very fascist, but it does the thing that the right loves doing, which is like occluding the presence of labor in anything.
Yeah.
You know, like labor is vital and necessary at all junctures.
Yeah. Who is making your meals?
Yes. I want to know who's cleaning the think tank compound.
Yeah, well, this is exactly the thing that always came up when we were talking about Resident Evil, right? Where, like,
again,
this is a Cold War movie, and what happened during the Cold War was not just the massive expansion of state spending on the military, but, like, the privatization of the military itself, right? Into these, like, mm-hmm. quote-unquote research centers and private military contractors, and it's like, okay, who's making your meals? Who is cleaning up after you? And it's always like this invisibilized mm-hmm. domestic reproductive labor. And of course, these scientists have fucked up because they left like the air filters open. So like the deadly,
right?
The deadly like zombie dust has made it into the compound. So they're already, it's not even like you have to beat these people. It's that like, because fascists have no theory of labor, because these eco-fascists have no theory of labor, they are going to wipe themselves out.
Yeah, because they're too busy like patting themselves on the back for being like, oh, we chose the most facts don't care about your feelings people to run our Zonenrad think tank in the fascist meteor chamber, that they like overlook the fact that they need to have like HVAC techs.
Yeah,
in their secure environment chamber,
mm-hmm.
and if they've forgotten that, like, they've forgotten so much else. If they can't even make sure that their like air ventilation system is working properly, which I think this also reveals, like, because like I don't know, like the bureaucratic nature of capitalism also loves reflecting fascism. It's almost as if capitalism and fascism wind up conjoining at a certain point. I wonder if there's any theoretical precedence for that. Do you know?
Yeah, no, I don't know if there's... Has anyone ever written anything about the decay of capitalism inevitably leading to, like, fascist neo-reaction? I don't know. Wild idea. Sorry.
Oh, you know, I think I heard that on All Gamers Are Bastards. I think where that's from.
Yeah, that's an AGAB reference. That's like... They talked about it in the context of the Final Fantasy franchise, if I remember right. But yeah, they did say something about, you know, fascism being capitalism in decay. I believe they were quoting the very first and actually only true gamer, which is Vladimir Lenin.
I'm just a sudden vision came to my mind, like a bolt in the blue here. Of Lenin with like the cat girl over ear headphones that have LED lights in them.
I
can see this as clear as day, which bothers me.
I guarantee you there is like a shit poster on Twitter who has that as their avatar.
Oh, there has to be.
Gaming
cat
Lenin,
girl Lenin has
like,
to exist.
Yeah, cat girl gaming Lenin has like 17,000 followers. It's also the avatar for my alt account, which none of you will ever find.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh dear. But I think this also dovetails us into a really nice point about mutual aid, a factor in Night of the Comet, because as we watch the kind of Malthusian like pro-fascist think tank crumble under the weight of its own ineptitude. We watch Sam, Regina, and Hector, which are three teenagers, like defeat them and join forces together and kind of like overcome what we'll talk about in a second was a very obvious racial divide between the two groups.
Yes.
Or at least begin to overcome that, rather. And like, I think this movie's drawing like really clear political lines where it's like, if you're looking from the outside, the think tank is the thing. Like, if you had to take a bet between like a kind of like budding mutual aid network and like a para governmental organization purpose built for withstanding this particular apocalypse, you know, like most people would bet on like the elite scientists and their super high tech bunker that I'm only assuming has a Tesla Hyperloop connecting it to something also useless. But that's God, like Resident Evil has just poisoned my understanding of all like underground zombie infrastructure because they all have those like silly little Hyperloop structures.
Yep.
But no, like when you would look at these two, like one on paper reads as just being so much more powerful, but then like you watch it shake down and like the one just like collapses under the weight of its own failure. And then the other has like this much stronger, much more elastic potential for survival.
I mean, I think maybe we're kind of, maybe we actually should foreground the racial divide here, right? Like, I always think of that, the incredible line by Stuart Hall that race is the modality through which class is lived and experienced.
Mm-hmm.
We are in we're in Southern California, right? And it is incredibly significant that it is Hector Gomez, who is a key part of not just helping these two young women survive, but actually like taking a kind of like central place in the kind of like quasi recreation of society that is post-apocalypse. I think there is clear resonances of like a multiracial feminist and I don't know if that it's fair to call them working class. I don't think that's true. But like this idea of like a broad spectrum of class dynamics that kind of coalesce into a specific movement against a exterminationist, eco-fascist think tank.
Yeah, right? I think you're absolutely correct. And like, so when Regina first meets Hector, like she says his name in a way that's really condescending and I think leaves the reader open to a reading of racism in her tone. And then doubles down on it later when, like, Hector reveals his, like, small pistol that he carries because it's the apocalypse and why not? And she's like, oh, that might cut it in the barrio, but it won't cut it in the zombie apocalypse. And, like, you know, what I read out of that is, like, well, we know her dad is doing Death Squad shit in South America.
Yeah.
And it would only stand to reason that Regina and Sam have picked up on her father's, what one could only assume is an incalculable, terrifying, and disgusting level of racism that he must bring home when he's done with his, like, terrifying missions.
Yeah, when he's done on his terrifying missions, like, murdering people who have names and look similar to Hector for doing things like, you know, trying to organize a trade union.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it is I don't know, there's something slightly hopeful in seeing that being overcome by these, like, you know, this ragtag group of teens.
Yeah. I think that's incredibly, incredibly inspiring, actually, because it drives home this message that actually it's social being that determines social relationships, not anything else. And like the eco-fascists would go, well, this is just how human nature is. And it's like, well, that's nonsense. Because when social being is determined, right, by social relationships, you can't, if you can kind of like rewire relationships in the context of a broader social totality being completely destroyed, you're going to get, there will be new ways of relating to each other. And there is something, you know, there's Ernst Bloch's famous line that Genesis lies at the end, not at the beginning. Right, every post-apocalypse is actually a Genesis moment. Right, just be something ending is always actually the beginning of something else. And yes, that can be an incredibly bleak statement, but it can also be one that's deeply hopeful, as we will see when we try and unpick a little bit of the contradictions and kind of tensions of the ending.
Yeah, and I think this is also a really good point to say, fuck Nick Land. If that wasn't clear earlier, I feel like we should make that clear as we say every time we evoke Nick Land's name with a hearty, fuck you, you fascist piece of shit.
Yeah, absolutely. Nothing but contempt for
it's
this.
It's good to cap that point there.
for this kind of like valorization of a sort of like crude Nietzschean system of domination.
Yawn.
Yeah, boring. Deeply boring. Eco-fascism is not just boring and has like no concept of labor, but it has no concept of social being, because it just takes that as like innate facts about the world. And when a when a privileged white girl from the valley can actually get past her learned behaviors of being racist and condescending to, you know, a guy called Hector from the barrio, then like maybe there is hope that maybe it's actually a good thing that certain things, that certain aspects of the world are going to end, because there's a chance for something new and better to come into being.
And this is, I think this is very revealing of like the last like 100 plus years of fascist politics, because they crave nothing if not biopower, right? Inscribed in their own fascist ideology, right? They crave some kind of essential biological, naturally proven superiority that they attempt to carve out of existence. And we see this in everything from the literal Nazis all the way up to like alpha male sigma nonsense today, which carries that same discursive seed. And like here in a movie that's like the historical predecessor of Buffy, that's about teen girls trying on fun outfits at an abandoned shopping mall, we see that ideology just stripped bare and annihilated, which fucking rules.
Oh, yeah. And we've got to talk about the shopping mall, because this is really interesting, right? The mall ceases to be a site of luxury when the world has ended, right? Because capitalism depends solely on enforced scarcity, right? It's no longer special if you can just walk in and take it, really, right? Because you don't have to pay for it anymore, because there's nobody to give your money to, and money is now worthless. So I think it's really interesting the film does this, which is like, it's the most like intuitive kid response, which is like, I can eat all the candy I want now.
Yeah.
Or I can get whatever I want. And then you realize that actually you get to see the mall for what it is, which is like this violently defended site of patriarchal exploitation. All the stock boys are super happy, right? Because they've got promoted. It's capitalism, and it's like the patriarchal aspect of capitalism in its barest form. Because
what
do they get to do now that they've been quote unquote promoted? Is use sexualized violence against young women, right? That's what they get to do. And this idea of like, well, you should want these things because they're expensive or they're hard to get, gets revealed to be completely like an artificially created desire.
Yeah, absolutely. It does really like, I think, expand nicely on the vision, because the mall, ever since Romero's classic film, has become the site for the zombie apocalypse. And this shows up in video games. It shows up in movies. This is kind of almost one of those mythical sites of like, as much as the vampire is a creature of like Central European castles and monarchies, the zombie is a creature of the American shopping mall and its adjacent structures. And I think that this film honestly plays with that trope in a way that is unique and kind of breaks from tradition. Because what we see in Dawn of the Dead, and what we kind of see going forward from that film, is like, at best, a really base critique of consumerism that doesn't necessarily extend into broader critiques of capitalism. And at worst, kind of just becomes like liberal moralist chiding of consumer behavior.
Yeah, you shouldn't like film, things which are branded. Probably,
yeah. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't want to be shopping. You should want to be learning how to harvest potatoes, you lazy employee. There's almost as if the script is being written by your manager, who's just trying to get you to work on your off hours. But what we see here with these teens, which I think is really fascinating, and this is something that I loved about Reggie's character, is that in the beginning, she is at work at a movie theater, and instead of working, she's just trying to get the high score in an arcade game and just completely ignoring her boss, and then just openly steals food, and then goes upstairs to have sex with her boyfriend instead of working.
Yep.
So there's just this complete disavowal of like work as the driving center of life in her character. And then we see that also when we get to the
based,
mall too,
because it's not. Say?
Oh, go on.
Just extremely cool, based. This is exactly the right attitude to have towards work. And you're completely right. I think it's...
Oh, I was just going to say that it's in the mall, too, because when Reggie and Sam are in the mall and they're like trying on clothes and like it's almost like straight out of Dawn of the Dead. It's almost literally just that scene of everyone kind of reveling and having access to these goods. But I think instead of reading this as like a now tut tut consumers, shouldn't you be being responsible in the zombie apocalypse? Instead, we should like read it on more personal terms, I think, and ask ourselves, like, why don't working people deserve that? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, why don't we deserve the ability to enjoy the fruits of our labor, right? Because it's not like they're not Scrooge McDucking themselves into like piles of gold. They're going to the mall and they're putting on fancy clothes and trying out cool sports gear and all the things we see in this movie in Dawn. And it's like, no, they're just like, these are things made by working class people, and these are working class people actually getting to enjoy them. And yes, this does kind of not include discourses about colonialism, which should be foregrounded here because none of those things were made in the United States. But it is a starting point for a larger conversation.
Well, I think the larger conversation is there is a really famous there's a really famous book by Frederick Jameson called An American Utopia, which is like a deeply controversial mm-hmm. book in his like body of work. But it includes a really interesting... Is what I'm thinking of in that book? No, sorry. This is in Valences of the Dialectic. Sorry, Jameson's written too many books. Jameson writes this really this really controversial essay called Walmart as Utopia, where it's like the criticisms yes. of Walmart, mm-hmm. everybody knows, right? We can all talk about the criticism of Walmart, and they're all true. But also, mm-hmm. he quotes yep. this nameless CEO who says that Walmart killed capitalism. Killed it. Destroyed it, right? Because it prioritizes centralization and efficiency and abundance. And like the mall, in a way, kind of represents both the apotheosis and the negation of American capitalism. This is a very American apocalypse, right? The apocalypse in Britain is like Children of Men, where it's this grim, slow grinding, this long unfolding of just life getting shittier yeah. and worse until there's something that kind of like fractures everything. The apocalypse in the American imagination is usually the moment, right? It's like the flick of the switch. It's the comet that arrives and like everybody's just gone. And what does that get you? It gets you access mm-hmm. to the utopian space of the mall, where suddenly there is no scarcity. Yeah. There is no limitation on what you can buy. Mostly not because prices have become so cheap, but because money itself has been abolished. Right? Money itself is no longer going to get you anything.
Yes, yes.
All you have to do is take what it is that you want. And it's so interesting mm-hmm. and it's so kind of revealing of the tensions of what it means to try and establish something new in the apocalypse when you will always have these forces of reaction against it, is that the mm-hmm. job of the stock boys is to violently defend the institutions and organizations of capitalism rather than just being like, well, commodity production is done now. It's not like you're going to get more stock, right? People can just take yeah, this yeah. stuff.
And I think what this brings to mind for me is a movie we talked about recently, Elves, which featured Dan yeah. Haggerty as Santa Claus. Because we have again, a very similar sequence of events. We have a bunch of teenage girls going to party in a mall. And in the case of Elves, it's late at night when the mall is closed and when similar rules apply. Those rules being, if the mall is closed, then there's no one there to enforce the strictures of capital. And I think, what's interesting here is it's always this kind of like reactionary patriarchal force that like Dan Haggerty is like a pseudo employee of the mall. He's not actually like a cop. But nevertheless, he enforces the structures of capital to maintain it, right? Same with the stock boys. Mm-hmm. And I think what we see with all these teenage girls is they're not like, and we even see this with the people in Dawn too, up until the like bikers show up anyway. But like, you know, their initial impulse isn't like, oh, I'm going to hoard all these fancy dresses and all this perfume and all these electronics. And then when other apocalypse survivors come, I'll barter for profit. No, they're just like, they're kind of reveling in access to stuff they've never had before. Right? Like there's kind of this like a catharsis about these sequences.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And there is this antinomy, there's this tension here, right? Between, you go, you want the thing which is expensive, but you don't have to you don't have to pay for it anymore, right? So, like, desire is always mediated through capital. Capitalism is a libidinal economy, right? So, what does it mean when the thing that you suddenly were told mm-hmm. to want because it's hard to get is now just immediately it's kind of like at hand, right? There are all of those, like, what is it that the systems of capitalism exist to do in the relationship between the consumer and the seller? In many ways, God, I always end up talking about Lacan. In many ways, it's to, like, mediate desire, right? I'm not Lacanian, yes. He insists, but, like, it's to mediate desire, right? You learn your desires through particularly advertising. There's an entire industry that exists to create desire. But when desire can be like, fulfilled so immediately, like, just you just walk in and take it. You no longer have to want anything. And I think you see a similar set of mm-hmm. contradictions and tensions in the quote-unquote family structure that emerges at the film's ending. And I think we should talk about family, we should talk about children, and we should talk about dating in the apocalypse.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about the ending? Yes, what are your thoughts about the ending?
The end of this movie is, I think, the most fantastic part of it. And I use fantastic here in the sense of fantasy. Mm-hmm. After Hector and the crew liberate everyone else from the kind of Malthusian fascist think tank compound and blow it up because they're all zombies now. They escape back to the city, and then we see, like, Hector is, and they find two other kids, right? Two young children, right? In the compound that are saved as well. And we see Hector and Regina dressed up in, like, nice adult TM clothing with their kids dressed up in nice kid clothing, kind of in a way mimicking and mirroring how they as teenagers would see, like, the adults dressing. Mm-hmm. And then Sam, who's, like, I think 13, super young, like some like dude starts speeding by with a sports car, and she hops in the sports car, and they drive off into the sunset together. So yeah. The ending of this movie is incredibly strange. hence me gnawing on it throughout pretty much the entirety of the précis.
Well, it's like, what are they doing at the end? And I actually think calling it fantastic is really on the money. Because what are they doing? Is that they're presenting a fantasy, right? Like, it's very telling that the father is mm-hmm. absent when the world is in place. There's only a stepmother. There isn't really this idealized fantasy of the nuclear family. So the kids stage the fantasy of it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they make the younger children that they've rescued dress up, and they're going to take, like, the family portrait. But
mm-hmm.
the kids are aware that they're just playing pretend, right? Especially the younger kids. They're like, do we have to do this? Why are you making us do this? So, like, it is a fantasy, but they are aware that they're participating in it. But, like, fantasy mm-hmm. aims at social reproduction, right? So when Sam goes off with the cool kid who just gets introduced at the end because he's got a fucking sick car, Reggie and Hector are sort of like the indulgent parents being like, okay, we'll make sure you're home by 11. And they even say this at the ending, right? Why are they doing it? They're doing it because mm-hmm. that's what civilization is, right?
Yeah.
Like, what an mm-hmm. amazing insight. What an incredible sentence. Like, yes, civilization
is this
accretion of, like, psychoanalytic fantasies that we put on, these social rituals and behaviors that we project mm-hmm. about ourselves in order to make sure that we perpetuate and maintain social reproduction, right? They have children now. They haven't had to do anything like have sex, but, like, that's all implicit in the kind of cinematic language of the text. But, like, civilization is a fantasy, and it's one that they seem to be, like, choosing to perpetuate in some ways at the end. I think the ending is very mm-hmm. ambiguous in its, like, in the ideological structures of the film. But I think that's a necessary compromise that they've made.
Yeah, I think the film has to stay ambiguous in what it's doing there at the end. It has to have this kind of, like, phantasmatic continuation of the before times.
yeah,
at the structure of the end of the film, because that is kind of at the heart of so many like post-apocalypse movies, is some kind of continuation of the pre-existing normal from beforehand.
And but you no longer have the absent father who is off like killing Nicaraguans, mm-hmm. right? You no longer have the absent father. The father is present. Yeah. The father is one of those Nicaraguans, right? Like, so there's change, but you know, there's still those same kind of root problems are still present.
Yeah. And I think like the obvious implication here is that, like, you know, because we learn through the lore of Night of the Comet that, like, if you're behind any structure stronger than steel and you can get lucky enough to not breathe in the meteor dust before it breaks down over the course of a week or two, you'll survive and be fine in the new world. Mm-hmm. And I think the implication of that is like, okay, well, it's reasonable to assume that some kind of like adult-led civilization will re-knit itself, especially in population centers as big as Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And like this then is like, it's this little fantasy. It's this little sliver, you know, before all of those like kind of languid adult conversations would come rolling in. Also, little thing, this would be my final thought here, but little thing about the end of the movie. So who's the bad guy in Night of the Comet? We have the comet. But that's like, I don't know, one does not blame the tornado for what it does. It's just a comet. He's just a little guy. He's Eepy. We've got the zombies. And like, also, as we discussed earlier, zombies, another natural phenomena, another Eepy little guy. Can't really blame them. Malthusian think tank death cult. They're definitely to blame. It's definitely their fault. But even after they're gone, who almost kills the two kids that Regina and Hector pseudo adopt?
Yep.
What almost kills and destroys them? It's a car. Cars are the enemy. Public trains, public transit, public trains forever. That's the lesson of Night of the Comet.
Yeah, absolutely. And like, it's very telling, right? That it's Sam is like very worried about dating in the apocalypse. And like, because mm-hmm. of that, she mm-hmm. runs off in this with DMK. What's his name? I've got it written down.
Yes, the guy teased at the beginning, whose initials displaced
Danny Mason Keener.
Initials at the arcade game.
Yeah, and like, you know, he's bad because he's like, he's very good at that arcade game, and he doesn't drive safely.
I used to play Tempest all of the time. That was one of the first video games I ever played, actually.
The 1981 Atari classic.
Fond memories of Tempest. What a wonderful game. Such pure simplicity.
Much like the movie itself.
It's just you and a bunch of little geometries.
Much like, there's a pure simplicity to this movie.
You know, much like this movie and like Tempest, in a way, we're all kind of caught in the tempest of these strange geometries that we call society. I think that is really deep.
All right. We wrap it there, I think.
Yeah, okay, that's where we gotta end this one. Well, thank you, Rowan, for suggesting Night of the Comet. We hope we've done justice to your suggestion here. And we look forward to shouting out more listeners who give us suggestions over at patreon.com/horrorvanguard, www.horrorvanguard.com.
We hope you've enjoyed the Dread Discourse. Until next week, stay spooky!